For how long?
For a year,
she said. Nobody spoke. What sort of cancer? Joe said.
Every sort there is, now.
Is it treatable? She just shook her head. Was it treatable?
I don't know,
she said.
I didn't ask.
What were the symptoms?
I had stomach aches. I had no appetite.
Then it spread?
Now I hurt all over. It's in my bones, and this stupid leg doesn't help.
Why didn't you tell us? She shrugged. Gallic, feminine, obstinate.
What was to tell?
She said. Why didn't you go to the doctor? She didn't answer for a time.
I'm tired,
she said.
Of what? Joe said. Life?
She smiled.
No, Joe. I mean, I'm tired. It's late, and I need to go to bed, is what I mean. We'll talk some more tomorrow. I promise. Don't let's have a lot of fuss now.
We let her go to bed. We had to. We had no choice. She was the most stubborn woman imaginable. We found stuff to eat in her kitchen. She'd laid in provisions for us. That was clear. Her refrigerator was stocked with the kind of things that wouldn't interest a woman with no appetite. We ate pâté and cheese and made coffee and sat at her table to drink it. The Avenue Rap was still and silent and deserted, 5 floors below her window. What do you think? Joe asked me. I think she's dying, I said. That's why we came, after all. Can we make her get treatment? It's too late. It'd be a waste of time, and we can't make her do anything. When could anyone make her do what she didn't want to? Why doesn't she want to? I don't know. He just looked at me. She's a fatalist, I said.
She's only 60 years old.
I nodded. She'd been 30 when I was born, and 48 when I stopped living wherever we called home. I hadn't noticed her age at all. At 48, she'd looked younger than I did when I was 28. I'd last seen her a year and a half ago. I'd stopped by Paris for 2 days en route from Germany to the Middle East. She'd been fine. She'd looked great. She was about 2 years into widowhood then, and, like with a lot of people, the 2-year threshold had been like turning a corner. She had looked like a person with a lot of life left.
Why didn't she tell us? Joe said.
I don't know. I wish she had. Shit happens, I said. Joe just nodded. She'd made up her guest room with clean, fresh sheets and towels, and she'd put flowers in bone china vases on the nightstands. It was a small, fragrant room full of 2 twin beds. I pictured her struggling around with her walker, fighting with duvets, folding corners, smoothing things out. Joe and I didn't talk. I hung my uniform in the closet and washed up in the bathroom. Set the clock in my head for 7 the next morning, and got into bed and lay there looking at the ceiling for an hour. Then I went to sleep. I woke at exactly 7. Joe was already up. Maybe he hadn't slept at all. Maybe he was accustomed to a more regular lifestyle than I was. Maybe the jet lag bothered him more. I showered and took fatigue pants and a t-shirt from my duffel and put them on. Found Joe in the kitchen. He had coffee going. Mom's still asleep, he said. Medication, probably. I'll go get breakfast, I said. I put my coat on and walked a block to a patisserie I knew on Rue Saint-Dominique. I bought croissant and pain au chocolat and carried the waxed bag home. My mother was still in her room when I got back.
She's committing suicide, Joe said. We can't let her.
I said nothing.
What? He said. If she picked up a gun and held it to her head, wouldn't you stop her?
I shrugged. She already put the gun to her head. She pulled the trigger a year ago. We're too late. She made sure we would be.
Why?
We have to wait for her to tell us. She told us during a conversation that lasted most of the day. It proceeded in bits and pieces. We started over breakfast. She came out of her room, all showered and dressed, and looking about as good as a terminal cancer patient with a broken leg and an aluminum walker can. She made fresh coffee and put the croissants I'd bought on good china, and served us quite formally at the table. The way she took charge spooled us all backwards in time. Joe and I shrank back to skinny kids, and she bloomed into the matriarch she had once been. A military wife and mother has a pretty hard time, and some handle it and some don't. She always had. Wherever we had lived had been home. She had seen to that.
I was born 300 meters from here,
she said,
on the Avenue Bosquet. I could see Les Invalides and the École Militaire from my window. I was 10 when the Germans came to Paris. I thought that was the end of the world. I was 14 when they left. I thought that was the beginning of a new one.
Joe and I said nothing.
Every day since then has been a bonus,
she said.
I met your father. I had you boys. I traveled the world. I don't think there's a country I haven't been to.
We said nothing.
I'm French,
she said.
You're American. There's a world of difference. An American gets sick, she's outraged. How dare that happen to her? She must have the fault corrected immediately, at once. But French people understand that first you live, and then you die. It's not an outrage. It's something that's been happening since the dawn of time. It has to happen, don't you see? If people didn't die, the world would be an awfully crowded place by now.
It's about when you die, Joe said. My mother nodded.
Yes, it is,
she said.
You die when it's your time.
That's too passive.
No, it's realistic, Joe. It's about picking your battles. Sure, of course you cure the little things. If you're in an accident, you get yourself patched up. But some battles can't be won. I don't think I didn't consider this whole thing very carefully. I read books, I spoke to friends. The success rates after the symptoms have already shown themselves are very poor. 5-year survival, 10%, 20%. Who needs it? And that's after truly horrible treatments.
It's about when you die. We spent the morning going back and forth on Joe's central question. We talked it through from one direction, then from another. But the conclusion was always the same. Some battles can't be won. And it was a moot point anyway. It was a discussion that should have happened a year ago. It was no longer appropriate. Joe and I ate lunch. My mother didn't. I waited for Joe to ask the next obvious question. It was just hanging there. Eventually, he got to it. Joe Reacher, 32 years of age, 6 feet 6 inches tall, 220 pounds, a West Point graduate, some kind of a Treasury Department big shot, placed his palms flat on the table and looked into his mother's eyes.
"Won't you miss us, Mom?"
he asked.
"Wrong question,"
she said.
"I'll be dead. I won't be missing anything. It's you that will be missing me, like you miss your father, like I miss him, like I miss my father and my mother and my grandparents. It's a part of life, missing the dead."
We said nothing.
"You're really asking me a different question,"
she said.
"You're asking, how can I abandon you? You're asking, aren't I concerned with your affairs anymore? Don't I want to see what happens with your lives? Have I lost interest in you?"
We said nothing.
"I understand,"
she said.
"Truly I do. I asked myself the same questions. It's like walking out of a movie, being made to walk out of a movie that you're really enjoying. That's what worried me about it. I would never know how it turned out. I would never know what happened to you boys in the end, with your lives. I hated that part. But then I realized, obviously I'll walk out of the movie sooner or later. I mean, nobody lives forever. I'll never know how it turns out for you. I'll never know what happens with your lives. Not in the end. Not even under the best of circumstances. I realized that. Then it didn't seem to matter so much. It will always be an arbitrary date. It will always leave me wanting more."
We sat quiet for a spell. "How long?" Joe asked.
"Not long,"
she said. We said nothing.
"You don't need me anymore,"
she said.
"You're all grown up. My job is done. That's natural, and that's good. That's life. So let me go."
By 6 in the evening, we were all talked out. Nobody had spoken for an hour. Then my mother sat up straight in her chair.
"Let's go out to dinner,"
she said.
"Let's go to Polydor, en rue Monsieur le Prince."
We called a cab and rode it to the Odeon. Then we walked. My mother wanted to. She was bundled up in a coat, and she was hanging on our arms and moving slow and awkward, but I think she enjoyed the air. Rue Monsieur le Prince cuts the corner between Boulevard Saint-Germain and Boulevard Saint-Michel in the 6e. It may be the most Parisian street in the whole of the city. Narrow, diverse, slightly seedy, flanked by tall plaster facades, bustling. Polydor is a famous old restaurant. It makes you feel all kinds of people have eaten there. Gourmets, spies, painters, fugitives, cops, robbers. We all ordered the same three courses. Chèvre chaud, porco pruno, dame blanche. We ordered a fine red wine. But my mother ate nothing and drank nothing. She just watched us. There was pain showing in her face. Joe and I ate, self-consciously. She talked exclusively about the past, but there was no sadness. She relived good times. She laughed. She rubbed her thumb across the scar on Joe's forehead and scolded me for putting it there all those years ago, like she always did. I rolled up my sleeve, like I always did, and showed her where he'd stuck me with a chisel in revenge, and she scolded him equally. She talked about things we'd made her in school. She talked about birthday parties we'd thrown on grim, faraway bases in the heat or the cold. She talked about our father, about meeting him in Korea, about marrying him in Holland, about his awkward manner, about the two bunches of flowers he'd bought her in all their 33 years together, one when Joe was born and one when I was. "Why didn't you tell us a year ago?" Joe asked.
"You know why,"
she said. "Because we would have argued," I said. She nodded.
"It was a decision that belonged to me,"
she said. We had coffee, and Joe and I smoked cigarettes. Then the waiter brought the bill, and we asked him to call a cab for us. We rode back to the Avenue Rap in silence. We all went to bed without saying much. I woke early on the fourth day of the new decade. Heard Joe in the kitchen talking French.
I went in there and found him with a woman. She was young and brisk. She had short, neat hair and luminous eyes. She told me she was my mother's private nurse, provided under the terms of an old insurance policy. She told me she normally came in 7 days a week, but had missed the day before at my mother's request. She told me my mother had wanted a day alone with her sons.